What's wrong?
Baring, Hambro, Lazard, Erlanger, Warburg, Schroeder, Seligman, the Spires, Mirabeau, Mallet, Fold, and above all, Rothschild and Morgan.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
I need something stronger.
Take 4 red capsules. In 10 minutes, take 2 more.
What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Citizens of a great democracy, or is something more convoluted and sinister at work? Is there anything wrong with the best and the brightest controlling our country, or potentially in the near future, the entire world? Are international financiers in control of our lives? Are they masters of the universe?
What's wrong with an elite ordering world events? There's a lot of things wrong with that. The American people, at least, have always been told that they control their own destiny through their elected representatives, but when you find their elected representatives behind closed doors, surrounded by armed guards who will not let the general public in, and they're making decisions that affect the future of the American people and the people of the world, then there are legitimate questions as to why this elite should be able to dictate things.
The whole point of one world government is to eliminate the concept of nationalism. Now, why is eliminating nationalism bad if it would eliminate war? Well, the reason is, if old British Lord Acton's axiom, that is, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely.
If you could print $1 billion tomorrow, well, you could be a master of the universe. But you can't, because they have the monopoly. As long as they can print the money, as long as they can buy the New York Times, the Washington Post, congressmen, senators, presidents, then you can't compete against them. What have you got to offer?
If you have relatively few people governing your government, you don't have a democratic government, do you? You've got a secret cabal here who is governing the United States. And not just the United States, but the governments of England and France, Germany, all the European countries, less influence in Japan, but quite a bit there too. So it's a conspiracy against the people of the United States and of the Western world. What would you call it?
Are the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the people in their sphere of influence the masters of the universe? Let's put it this way, they want to be the masters of the universe, but there are a lot of people who don't want them to be.
Nobel Prizeist Milton Friedman claimed that the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression by deliberately reducing the amount of money in circulation.
Depositors all over the country were frightened about the safety of their funds and rushed to withdraw them. There were runs, there were failures of banks by the droves, and all the time the Federal Reserve System stood idly by when it had the power and the duty and the responsibility to provide the cash that would have enabled the banks to meet the insistent demands of their depositors without closing their doors.
Congressman Lewis McFadden, chairman of the House Banking Committee during the crash, agreed, saying, "The Great Depression was a carefully contrived occurrence by international bankers seeking to bring about a condition of despair so that they might emerge as the rulers of us all."
There was a memo circulated in advance of the stock market collapse. All the big guys, or the insiders, let's say, got out of the stock market during that four-year period. They all got out. They were cash-heavy when the market crashed. They were able to buy up major corporations for pennies on the dollar.
Franklin Roosevelt's own son-in-law called the Depression the deliberate shearing of the public by the world money power, triggered by the planned sudden shortage of call money in the New York markets. Insider Joseph Kennedy's wealth grew from $4 million in 1929 to over $100 million 4 years later. Then, as now, America's press failed to tell us what was happening. These scenes of unrest in America have never been seen before. Cameramen would shoot them, but newsreels wouldn't play them. Controlling the news started early in America. Of course, the lighter side of the news continued to get lots of play. One of the stickiest questions in this debate is this. Just who owns the Federal Reserve?
The City of London set the whole thing up. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is principally owned by five merchant banks in London, chartered by the Bank of England.
Perhaps England, which many have considered a political satellite of the United States in recent years, is really the one pulling the strings of international policy.
It's not a matter of who owns the Fed, it's who controls it. The government has given the banks a monopoly, and then you see the Justice Department doing nothing about the bank mergers. A monopoly can only exist with government assistance, and they've given great assistance to the banking monopoly.
Oh, well, you see, here's the nice thing. The wonderful thing about the Fed is that it has no constraints or limits, and to suggest that the Federal Reserve is getting rich or the Bank of England is getting rich is really not to draw the picture. It is that the owners of these institutions funnel the money to themselves. It is not the institutions themselves, but the, as Thomas Jefferson put it, the corporations that will grow up around them. So they set up these quasi-public corporations, and then they do business with private corporations that make tons of money in the process. In the case of Goldman Sachs, their profits are obscene.
Drain the people, drain them dry. Drain the people, hear them cry. Drain the people, drain them dry. Drain the people, watch them die. I took a walk through the stately insane. I stopped to watch the procession of pain. The people burned, but the kingdom remained. rain, and all the lovers united with the ball and the Taino. To ring the people, train them cry. To ring the people, hear them cry. To ring the people, train them cry.
A number of years ago, the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, produced a document entitled Modern Money Mechanics. This publication detailed the institutionalized practice of money creation as utilized by the Federal Reserve and the web of global commercial banks it supports. On the opening page, the document states its objective. The purpose of this booklet is to describe the basic process of money creation in a fractional reserve banking system. It then proceeds to describe this fractional reserve process through various banking terminology, a translation of which goes something like this. The United States government decides it needs some money, so it calls up the Federal Reserve and requests, say, $10 billion. The Fed replies, saying, sure, we'll buy $10 billion in government bonds from you. So the government takes some pieces of paper, paints some official-looking designs on them, and calls them treasury bonds. Then it puts a value on these bonds to the sum of $10 billion and sends them over to the Fed. In turn, the people at the Fed draw up a bunch of impressive pieces of paper themselves, only this time calling them Federal Reserve notes, also designating a value of $10 billion to the set. The Fed then takes these notes and trades them for the bonds. Once this exchange is complete, the government then takes the $10 billion in Federal Reserve notes and deposits it into a bank account. And upon this deposit, paper notes officially become legal tender money, adding $10 billion to the U.S. money supply. And there it is. $10 billion in new money has been created. Of course, this example is a generalization, for, in reality, this transaction would occur electronically, with no paper used at all. In fact, only 3% of the U.S. money supply exists in physical currency. The other 97% essentially exists in computers alone.
On October 30th, 1938, the Mercury Radio Network interrupts the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra from the Park Plaza Hotel of New York City for a special news bulletin. The infamous War of the Worlds broadcast begins with its terrifyingly real description of an invasion from Mars. And before the night is out, a million people will run panicked into the streets.
I'm extremely surprised to learn that a story which has become familiar to children through the medium of comic strips and...
After what has been a closely guarded secret for nearly 50 years, Orson Welles' original broadcast turns out to be no mere show business stunt.
Should have had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
But instead was a complex psychological warfare test conducted by C.D. Jackson for the Rockefeller Foundation. When the results are compiled nearly 2 years later, they are released to an elite whose names most men will not speak of over a whisper.
C.D. Jackson was the equivalent of being the head of the National Security Council in the White House under Eisenhower. He was the chief of psychological warfare.
The breakthrough discovery that the War of the Worlds broadcast was actually a psychological warfare test is key to understanding why experts believe that the Federal Reserve, the Bilderbergers, and other closed exclusive elite groups are pulling the strings that control our societies.
Well, it's a fraternity. They have a common objective, and this common objective is to maintain control.
America grew so rapidly and became wealthy so quickly that really we've always been the thorn in the side of this New World Order crowd. They've just never been able to get us completely under their control. So America is the target, and once they finally get us subdued, the rest of the world would fall very quickly.
Moguls like the late J.P. Morgan, a man so excessively wealthy his likeness adorns the tycoon card in the board game Monopoly, are all safely cloaked behind their own carefully constructed versions of history. But are the private agenda of these select few woven permanently into the fabric of world economy? Are we simply the unwitting pawns in a game whose rules were written amidst the clandestine corridors of private social clubs 100 years ago or more?
And now a word from our sponsor. the John Wilkes Booth fully privatized chief executive retirement plan.
The global elite have been the primary promoters of free trade precisely because of the fact that they are the ones who control the major multinational corporations. They are the ones who want to build televisions in Mexico and in impoverished third world countries and pay these people sub-minimum wages, slave wages, and then export them at gigantic profits back to the United States. But we're told by the major media in this country, which is tied in again with these international elites, that, oh, well, this is a temporary thing. It really is good for America. But it's not good for America. Look at anybody who's lost their job. Look at how their family suffers. That's the Bilderberg Group at work. That's the Trilateral Commission. That's the Federal Reserve. All these elite groups that they're benefiting, but the average American isn't.
These families have been mostly in the banking business for at least 500 years, most of them. They were in the slave trade. They were in the opium trade because these people are not interested in 5% a year return. They want 1,000% a year return. And to get into those things, you need to get into gold, slaves, drugs. That's where the big money is.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When human rights groups discover that our third world sweatshops employ a lot of child labor, they're always horrified. These children should be in school, they stridently insist. But why would these kids be better off sitting at a desk learning about social studies than working on our assembly lines? Schools are supposed to prepare you for the future. In most of the places we do business, the only future these moppets have is on an assembly line. What better way for them to prepare than in our sweatshop apprentice program? The kids get paid a special introductory wage while they learn all the skills they'll need for the rest of their short, miserable lives. And those little hands can do some really intricate stitching, believe me. This has been Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
You got a penthouse in the city and another home in the hills. You got a corner office on the 51st floor and you walk on a carpet made of $100 bills. Well, I look at you up there in your plush office chair, and I wonder what is going through your brain. As you look outside your window, watch the people moving by below, you must be thinking about your capital gains. Now you look me in the eye and tell me exactly what it is you do. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you make your money from the groovy work that other people do. Well, that's living away in fields and factories. You're sipping your coffee on Madison Avenue. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul?
Privileged and powerful are those who own the banks, corporations, factories, mines, news and entertainment industries, and agribusiness firms of this country. They are what is meant by the owning class, or the very rich. The ruling elites, or ruling class, are the politically active portion of the owning class. They and their faithful acolytes compose the Business Roundtable, the Business Council, the Trilateral Commission, and the Council on Foreign Relations, organizations started by the Rockefellers, Mellons, Morgans, and other economic royalists. They are the people who become the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Treasury, the National Security Advisors, and CIA Directors. Indeed, they become Presidents, Vice Presidents, and Senators. For the very top positions of state, the ruling class is largely self-recruiting. When wealth and class play such a dominant role in the selection of leadership, there seems to be little opportunity for progressive betterment. Popular sentiment is often denied a hearing. People are repeatedly deceived or distracted with a never-ending panorama of pop culture and media puffery. Dissidents are harassed, suppressed, and sometimes even assassinated. In time, people lapse into cynicism. People are not likely to start a fight if they're certain that they're going to be penalized for their efforts. So they remain quiet. Some commentators treat this political discouragement and quietude as contentment. They say we're too happy with our abundance and freedom to engage in political struggle. Yet, despite the powerful array of forces against them, many people still protest, resist, and fight back, sometimes with an impressive measure of success. In recent decades, we've witnessed a number of powerful democratic movements. The civil rights protests to enfranchise African Americans in the South and end lynch mob rule and segregation. The civil liberties struggle against McCarthyism and government harassment of dissidents. The movement to end the Vietnam War. The anti-imperialist solidarity for freedom fighters in El Salvador and for the Sandinista Nicaraguans. The attempt to build alternative educational institutions and alternative media. The movement for a nuclear freeze and an end to the arms race, and the struggles for women's rights, gay rights, ecology, and environmentalism. During these same years, there have been long and bitter labor struggles valiantly fought by coal miners, steel workers, farm workers, airline employees, newspaper staff, bus drivers, teachers, university staff, hospital workers, and many others, though most of these struggles go unreported in the business-owned media. Still, while probably none of these mass movements and labor struggles have met with unqualified success, all have made a difference. All have had an impact in limiting how far the rich and powerful dare go in advancing their otherwise uncompromising pursuit of profit and privilege. The conventional view is that power is antithetical to freedom, a threat to it. This can be true of state power and corporate power and other forms of institutionalized authority. But popular power and freedom are not antithetical, but complementary. If you don't have the power to limit the abuses of wealth and position, you don't have much freedom. In order to wrest democratic gains from ruling interests, the people must mobilize a countervailing power. The concessions of the privileged to the unprivileged, wrote John Stuart Mill in 1869, are so seldom brought about by any other better motive than the power of the unprivileged to extort them. In 1857, Frederick Douglass wrote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will." Unquote. The goal of popular action is not only to limit or rebuff state power, but to make it work for democratic ends as opposed to plutocratic ends. Rather than saying you can't fight City Hall, we might better say we can't afford not to. It's often frustrating and sometimes dangerous to challenge those who control the land, capital, and technology of society. But in the long run, it's even more dangerous not to.
My son said, "Daddy, I don't want to go to school because the teacher's a jerk. He must think I'm a fool and all the kids smoke reefer. I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. I dance to the beat, shuffle my feet, wear a shirt and tie and run with the creeps because it's all about money. Ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey."
The ancient goldsmiths discovered that extra profits could be made by rowing the economy between easy money and tight money. When they made money easier to borrow, then the amount of money in circulation expanded. Money was plentiful. People took out more loans to expand their businesses. But then the money changers would tighten the money supply. They would make loans more difficult to get.
What would happen? Just what happens today. A certain percentage of people could not repay their previous loans and could not take out new loans to repay the old ones. Therefore, they went bankrupt and had to sell their assets to the goldsmiths for pennies on the dollar.
The same thing is still going on today. Only today, we call this rowing of the economy up and down the business cycle.
Thank you.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Was a farming on the shares, and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Now as I look around, it's mighty plain to see, this world is such a great and a funny place to be. Oh, the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Our Federal Reserve and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. I mean, are we all plugged in?
Oh, yes. In fact, you know, those institutions and the Bank of International Settlements, those institutions were established to further cement the power of the Federal Reserve and the central banks of other nations. You know, every time we've been successful in an incursion, be it a war or a police action, the one thing that comes from it is always the same, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of France, the Bank of Italy, you know, the central bank established in that country, the Bank of Iraq. You know, 20 minutes after we go there, the first thing we do is establish a central bank. And in this, these central banks have very strong ties back to this supranational BIS, or International Monetary Fund. And the idea is that this is a world organization that is exempt from the jurisdiction of the United States. And so when we send money to the IMF, then we don't get to say how they spend it. But when we grant the BIS special clearing privileges, we don't get to monitor or send the IRS in or have the, you know, the federal attorney investigate their actions. They are completely above the law. And so these institutions were not only fostered, they were in fact established by the very same people who own and control the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States.
The fractional reserve policy perpetrated by the Federal Reserve, which has spread in practice to the great majority of banks in the world, is, in fact, a system of modern slavery. Think about it. Money is created out of debt. And what do people do when they are in debt? They submit to employment to pay it off. But if money can only be created out of loans, how can society ever be debt-free? It can't. And that's the point. And it is the fear of losing assets coupled with the struggle to keep up with the perpetual debt and inflation inherent in the system, compounded by the inescapable scarcity within the money supply itself, created by the interest that can never be repaid, that keeps the wage slave in line.